Session number 13653, reel number 2.
Mr. Brain, reel 2.
We then were merged with another squadron to form the very much enlarged B squadron under the command of Major Peter Patrick, who was a splendid man, who was the most popular officer and had an utter contempt when necessary for military rules and regulations, and very, very sensibly taught his officers and senior NCOs to consider such things with a high degree of suspicion. We entered then into a lot of training, mainly up in the battle area in Norfolk, where one moment we would be deployed with perhaps a corps representing the Germans invading on the North Norfolk coast, and the next time we would be with one of the British divisions on the defensive side. But we really worked jolly hard indeed, often going out on a Sunday and coming back on a Saturday night, and sometimes leaving 2 days later on another exercise to work with another formation. It had been arranged for a number of officers to take their patrols to do a commando course lasting 2 or 3 weeks up in Scotland. And this involved a voluntary jumping out of an aircraft at least 3 times, twice by day and once by night. Well, I didn't mind meeting the Germans on my 2 flat feet, but I never fancied very much jumping out of aircraft, not liking heights. And I'm glad to tell you that I sprained my ankle about 2 days before. I couldn't go up on this dreadful course. Now then, in May 1944, the Earl of Rosslyn, who was one of my brother officers, asked me if I would like to go with him for the weekend and spend the weekend with the then Duchess of Kent and her family. And I said, well, I'd never stayed with royalty in my life. I would like to. This was at the place called the Iver, or the Coppins, at Iver in Buckinghamshire. However, believe it or not, brain's luck, I looked at the list of duty officers, and I was the duty officer on the Sunday, so I never went to stay with the Duchess of Kent.
Were you having to, at this stage, do any special training for D-Day?
We had done a lot of special training, particularly after our vehicles were waterproofed, in case we had to make a wet landing. And we had repeatedly had exercises involving river crossings and similar to try and make us prepared for the landing over the beaches of Normandy. In fact, my squadron were under command Canadian Army, and we were told that Canadian Army would land on D+8. Because of the storm damage to the mulberries, to the mulberry on the American beach, we didn't, the Canadian Army didn't go across until the second half of July. And we were champing at the bit, rather, in England at the time, hoping that we could get there before Second World War ended. On D-1, I was ordered to Southbrook House near Fareham, which was the headquarters from which Eisenhower made the decision to go tomorrow on June the 6th. And I was in the enclosure in the front of that house when I had in my hand one of the 100 copies of Montgomery's order, operational order, for the launch of D-Day. And I was tremendously impressed when I saw intention at the top of this order of the day, intention to destroy the German state. I was then ordered to go to Hayling Island to take up a position and try to intercept the command nets of the British forces landing in Normandy the following morning. one or two other of my brother officers, one patrol went to Saucy Bill, and they were spread along the south coast. But unfortunately, probably because the Isle of Wight was in the way, I got no traffic at all. And later that morning, packed up and returned to Southbrook, or Southmead House, whatever was the name of the house. And then there was no further need for my services, so I was returned to Nutfield Ridge, near Reigate, near Red Hill, where the squadron had been based for the previous winter. Whilst there, we encountered the first flying bomb, which was quickly nicknamed a doodle bug by Tommy Atkins. And I happened to be the duty officer that night when my corporal came hurriedly into the officer's mess to say that there was a, it seemed to him, an aircraft in distress going over, and would I like to come out and see what was happening? Well, I had been warned about these so-called flying bombs and various secret weapons that Hitler had up his sleeve, but the troops didn't seem to have been told, and I was able then to tell him that's a flying bomb, and it was the first that we had seen. Very quickly, they followed over the officer's mess, which was on the top of the North Downs, looking over the Weald of Sussex. And very quickly, they followed in considerable numbers. And very quickly also, barrage balloons were set up between us and the South Downs, and it was interesting to see that quite a number of the wires of these barrage balloons brought down quite a few doodle bugs. One did drop in the village, which was about 3 miles east of Red Hill, and it killed a number of chaps in an RASC unit, billeted in the village. But otherwise, most of them went over us to reach London, and on two occasions we saw Spitfire shoot them down, which was quite exciting to watch.
Did it make you wonder whether Hitler could retrieve the war situation through the use of the V-weapons?
Not really, because this depended upon the morale of the British people. And I think once D-Day had happened and we were lodged, looked fairly securely on the northern coast of France, then I don't think the British people were prepared to throw in the towel at that stage. Early in July 1944, the squadron received orders to stand by to move to an embarkation point near Tilbury Docks. And about a week later, the red message came through, and we moved to these docks at near Tilbury, and we then spent a few days waiting for the order to get on one of the ships.
This is the whole of B Squadron?
Actually some had already gone, been borrowed, and had already gone to assist Phantom in the beachhead at Normandy.
What was your crossing like?
Well, I was just coming to that. I boarded a ship called the Park Benjamin on the morning of Monday the 24th of July. The Park Benjamin had been an American Liberty ship, but was very nicely appointed, despite the fact that she was mainly built for war service. The convoy moved out late on the afternoon, and it must have been several miles long because I seem to recall a tremendous number of ships. We, of course, had to go round the North Foreland and through the Straits of Dover, so we were escorted most of this way by British destroyers. I was quite excited. I thought we were bound to receive some attention from the German guns at Cap Grenet, and I sat up most of the night on the deck to see if any fun would begin. Believe it or not, this enormous convoy went through the Straits of Dover, and the Germans must have known that we were going through, and not a single shot was fired either way. So we arrived at dawn off the southern tip of the Isle of Wight. St. Catherine's Point was the last bit of England I saw before we turned south for Normandy. We got to Normandy on the Tuesday and were parked, I should say berthed, I suppose, under the guns of the British battleship Warspite. We hadn't been there very long when we formed the usual queue to get some food, and I remember going up a companionway with a Dixie of hot soup in one hand and a Dixie of hot tea in the other. I got halfway up this companionway when the Warspite fired a broadside, and the 7,000 or 8,000 ton Liberty ship shook like an aspen leaf, and I got scalding tea and soup all over both my hands. I had never been under the broadside of a big British battleship, and I believe the Warspite had some of the biggest guns ever mounted by the Royal Navy. But it was a fantastic experience because it was like so many express trains rushing over the masts of our ship, shaking the ship from stem to stern. And this went on frequently every day and most nights. And by night, of course, the whole of the beachhead was lit up with what was virtually a Brock's benefit. Star shells and everything, and you couldn't sleep. It was too exciting to sleep because everything was happening. There was a fearful lot of noise, and I suppose the trouble was too many of us were too keen to get stuck into Germans, and we probably learned before too long how foolish we had been. Anyway, again, cut a long story short, I landed at Courcelles on Friday the 28th of July, exactly a month after we should have got there. We landed on Mike Beach, and I was quickly deployed to the 4th Canadian Armoured Division, which itself had only recently arrived in Normandy. We took up our position adjacent to the headquarters of the division in some German trenches in the grounds of an old chateau. And although the Germans shelled us whenever they could and frequently at night, we didn't bother too much in our slit trenches. But the biggest pest in the Orne Valley were the mighty great mosquitoes. And they really were... You couldn't sleep because they would buzz over you almost all night.
Did you have any repellent or...?
No, we used anti-gas ointment, which seemed to keep them away. On Monday the 7th of August, the Polish Armoured Division and the 4th Canadian Armoured Division were lined up with several other infantry divisions to comprise Operation Totalize. And the object of this was to close the gap on the 7th German Army, which was even then, despite some hard fighting to come, it was even then obvious that they were going to have to pull out eastwards. And the Poles and the Canadians were the two most easterly armoured divisions capable, perhaps, of stopping them on the eastern flank of the bridgehead. After a short stay with the 4th Canadian Armoured Divisional headquarters, where we had one or two very unpleasant nights, on one occasion, I remember the German fighters strafing us. They missed our headquarters, I'm glad to say, but we, all the officers at this O group taking place, jumped to the ground, crashed to the ground, and in going down, I was struck by the plastic, whatever you call them, we used to use on our mat boards. Can't remember the technical name now. And this slit the side of my face. And when the raid was over, we got up, all the officers looked at me in a most concerned way because my one half of my face was covered in blood, which I hadn't even noticed simply because of the sharp edge of this map board belonging to the brigadier commanding the guns in the 4th Armoured Division, who, poor man, was to lose his life a little later on in the war. But I'm glad to say that I was able to wash the blood off, and it didn't amount to much. For some reason I never really knew, I was then switched to the Polish Armoured Division. They were on the east side of the Conflans Road, and their role was, I always thought, to do a sort of cleaning up operation to try and catch any German elements who escaped from the net of Normandy thrown by the Allies. We didn't have a great deal of success in the first phase, and one of the reasons for this was the divisions, the tanks were lining up in the suburbs of Caen, and on the very first morning, about an hour before we were to pass over the start line, 21 American Liberators pattern bombed us. Now, this was an absurd situation. The British Army had been in Caen nearly a month. The world had announced this fact on every headline that I saw, and the Americans must have known that their allies were in Caen, but they obviously didn't know where they were because they unleashed their bombs upon the Poles and the Canadians mainly. And it is a fact that that cost the Poles and Canadians some 65 dead and 250 wounded. So the offensive had got off to a bad start, particularly as it also fired the Canadian Corps ammunition dump, which went on exploding for several days afterwards.
How close to you did the bombs come?
So close that I was blown across the road. Fortunately, none of my men were hurt, and none of my vehicles. But I was blown, I should think, about 12 or 15 feet. But that just shook me up, but it didn't do any further damage.
Did you realize what was happening?
Oh, yes, because we recognized the American aircraft. And one of the Polish staff officers, whom I knew, came running down the road swearing in Polish and English about the American airmen, who obviously hadn't a clue where they were. However, we survived that lot, but the next few days were really tough going for the tanks. The Germans fought doggedly and efficiently to try and stop us closing what was to be known as the gap at Falaise, because this was their way back to Germany if they had to withdraw. About a week later, the Allied push having run into the ground, we were to be supported by the Royal Air Force. And I'm told that the raid was about, the raid consisted of 800 aircraft. And at 3 o'clock one afternoon, on a beautiful day, these 800 aircraft came in waves. The first wave passed over us and dropped its bombs where the Germans were in the middle of the wood facing us. But the second wave unloaded their bombs upon us. This was another terrible mistake, I believe, caused by the fact that the leader of this wing miscalculated the mileage from the coast to where the German positions were, and we Oh, dear. And we fortunately escaped without any injuries to my patrol. But the Poles and the Canadians again took a pasting, and some 200 were wounded, and about 150, mainly Canadians and Poles, lost their lives. The Germans were entrenched in something called Fresnay Wood. Correction, Quesnay Wood. And it was quite extraordinary to see British 5.5 medium howitzers being towed out of battle with their barrels twisted round like question marks by the Royal Air Force high explosive bombs. Full stop. This was a most peculiar day, because later that afternoon, when we were helping odd units which had been affected by the mistake of the Royal Air Force, an ambulance carrying wounded going back along the Cornfelais Road was attacked by a Spitfire. Now, it was against international convention anyway for an ambulance to be attacked by either side. But this, there was no doubt about it, this was a Spitfire with RAF markings on it, and it shot up this ambulance, which rolled over a burning mass into the ditch.
Do you think there was any excuse for it?
I cannot think of anything, unless it was a Spitfire stolen by the Germans on some other front. I have just found the date of the bombing by the RAF on the Poles and Canadians, and it was, in fact, the 14th of August, 1944. I discovered that with no relief as a phantom officer, and one would have to watch the happening of events round the clock, that I was getting thoroughly tired. Most of my men took it in turns to man the radio and then had a bout of sleeping, but there was nobody to take my place. And sometimes O groups were called in the small hours of the morning, and by the time I'd got back and written the information and had it encoded and seen it sent off, there was often no more than an hour or so for me to catnap before I had to be in attendance upon the command vehicle once again. And gradually, with much loss of life and equipment, the Canadians and the Poles reached Falaise, and as history has recorded, the Polish Armoured Division became the cork in the bottle, or tried to be. The tragedy was that they had run out of ammunition and were themselves often prey to some of the German tanks that were trying to escape along these country lanes, simply because they couldn't answer them back. The carnage was appalling. I was with General Maciek and the Polish command vehicle, which he always took as far forward as he possibly could, and I could see with my binoculars the German troops trying to get out from Normandy up this narrow valley, up about two lanes in this narrow valley. And the Royal Air Force from time to time would strafe them, and the Americans under General Patton were coming up from the south to try and close the gap, and they were a bit enthusiastic from time to time, and we received a number of their shells. It was, let's face it, a bit of a shambles. I had been on active service constantly by the beginning of the last week in August without a break, and I think squadron headquarters back at Canadian Army began to realize that the quality of my messages were falling. And I was relieved by my old friend Barry Coward, even though as the moment he relieved me, we were strafed by German fighters, it was almost the last time I was to see them for some weeks. because by then the German army was in full retreat across France. I was relieved, and I returned on a Friday afternoon to squadron headquarters in the corner of a peaceful cornfield in Normandy. I had a meal and went to sleep in a tent on the side of this cornfield. And the next, what I thought was the next morning, I went down to where I saw the smoke curling up and assumed was the cookhouse to get a cup of tea. And the cook sergeant said to me, "Did you enjoy your sleep yesterday, sir?" I said, "What on earth do you mean?" Well, he said, "It's Sunday morning now." I had slept right through the Saturday. He said, "I brought you tea two or three times, but you didn't. I couldn't wake you." And it was the longest time I've ever slept in my life because I really was utterly exhausted. After a couple of nights there, on the Sunday morning, my patrol and I were moved out this time because the Polish Armored Division had been pulled out of action. We were moved out to the 6th Airborne Division. And there I met my old friend. George Hales was the padre's name, and he was very highly thought of in the headquarters of the 6th Airborne Division because he was the first padre to jump to touch down before daylight on D-Day, and it was told of him that when the Germans got too close to the wounded place, was it not wounded, to the casualty position where I think he was carrying out the last rites in many cases, he picked up a dead paratrooper's gun and went looking for Germans himself. He was a crack shot, and he would never admit to that, being a man of the cloth, but he was very highly thought of in the 6th Airborne Division. Whilst with the paras, I was ordered to do my first mission sortie.